The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, we'll be talking about childhood obesity and what one doctor and his company are doing to address metabolic disease. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Sujit Sharma. Dr. Sharma went to medical school and did his residency in pediatrics at Wayne State University Children's Hospital of Michigan. He did a 3-year fellowship in pediatric emergency medicine at Harvard Medical School at Boston's Children's Hospital. He moved to Atlanta in 2001 after completing his fellowship to begin a practice with Pediatric Emergency Medicine Associates. He still works with the practice and works in several hospitals around Atlanta. He's currently the Vice Section Chief, Department of Emergency Medicine, Children's Healthcare of Atlanta at Scottish Rite. He's been the CEO for CHOOSE for about 6 years and currently serves on the board of directors for Georgia Organics, where he's serving as moderator for the Food as Medicine Committee. Dr. Sharma, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm delighted you're here. You know, as I was looking at some of your credentials, it occurred to me we were in Boston at the same time doing our residency.
Absolutely.
And I have to say, two out of three of my kids have already had a visit to Scottish Rite Emergency Room. So I'm going to start off by thanking you for taking such good care of the kids that go there.
Thanks. We love doing what we do.
It's amazing, I think, how kids can land in emergency rooms in
absolutely.
No time.
Thank you for taking care of adults so I don't have to, because I just can't imagine taking care of adults. I'd love to just stay in pediatrics. I think that's how most of us in pediatrics feel, too.
Well, now, pediatrics and emergency room, interesting background. So you must see a whole spectrum of health diseases. And I think one thing, just reading the editorial that you wrote for CNN, is just observation about obesity in childhood and the rising rates, which I think a lot of people now are very aware of because there are a lot of news stories. And our children being the first children in nearly 200 years where the life expectancy is supposed to be less for them than it is for us.
Right.
So talk a little bit about what you're seeing taking care of children, why this has become the problem that it is, and maybe what can we start doing about it?
Yeah, it's a huge topic, and it's surprisingly more challenging than we would realize or we would think. First, we've become numb to it because these things kind of happen slowly. Yeah. But if you look, I've been in practice here now for 17 years in Atlanta, similar to you. And it's if you look back this point in time, to when I started, to see the difference in what we would see routinely, there's been a massive shift in terms of what is typical nowadays for 10-year-old kids for us to see coming in for other conditions that bring them to the emergency room. You're doing your physical exam, and then you notice this finding on the back, this term, acanthosis nigricans, which in medicine, which means it's a darker skin individuals especially, it's this change in the texture and the sort of wrinkliness and thickening of the skin around the back of the neck that indicates signs of type 2 diabetes. When I started practice here, it was not something we saw routinely in 10-year-olds, but we see this routinely now, and it is a serious concern. When the first study from the New England Journal of Medicine really reported, it's in 2005, on the likelihood that this next generation of kids will likely live not as long as their parents, it was a wake-up call that is very difficult for us to be able to do anything with. And I equate it to tobacco. And if you look at the history of tobacco over the last 50 years, it really was 40, 50 years ago when we realized the way we advertised and marketed tobacco and tobacco products was wrong, and it made a stand to make it a public policy change. Half as many people die now from tobacco-related causes as they did 50 years ago, so about 1 million people a year used to die. Now it's about 500,000. Still a problem, but it was really the public policy shift that changed it. Today in our world with food marketing, you know, to me there's no doubt. 3 decades from now, we're going to look back at the way we market food, especially to kids. Because I'm like you, you know, you have 12, 10, and 7. I have two, a girl and a boy, who are 13 and 11. And it is watching them grow up and watching TV and just turning my head like, you know, watch the commercials that are on. And sometimes, you know, you're just not really paying attention. Then you stop and you listen. You're like, that's kind of crazy, you know, like what they're being sort of the visuals that they're being shown and this idea of happiness being associated with delving into an indulgence of, you know, of some kind of cereal made out of chocolate chip cookies. I mean, it's just, this is where we've gotten to. And, you know, for adults driving down the road every day, we're all immersed in these ads and marketing that tells us you deserve a break today. And it really is, to me, it's a shame. It's going to take a few decades for us to realize this is not ethical. It was morally wrong. How can we, you know, advertise or compel another human being to eat irrationally, where it's something that we know? I mean, you know, in a single $4 deal, your typical ad, you're driving around the streets of Atlanta, you see the ad for the $4 deal, and it's two fried sandwiches, some kind of fried starchy carb, and a large sweet tea for $4. And we're going to look back at this and say, what were we thinking? But unfortunately, why does it take 3 decades? And that's the reality of today's world. And, you know, getting towards like, well, how do we fix it? I mean, the solution is going to be, just like tobacco, is when it's a public policy shift. And but that's a long ways away. But there are examples around the world of this happening. New York Times does amazing reporting on global food trends that we started. You know, America we sort of created lifestyle disease. And the only upside to me I see is that we also have the opportunity to fix it, you know, and help, because it's global now. You know, if you look at Brazil and Chile, in Brazil, there was a major shift, a major push to implement policy changes. And those people who were pushing that lost. The big food companies came in, a lot of capital was put into it, and they kind of lost. But in Chile, there was, for whatever reason, they were able to adopt the policy changes that really, it's going to take some time, but could very well be very impactful. And that we'll really see this data very clear 10 years from now about the impact when you can't advertise food in certain places, you know, because food companies would love to advertise at sports arenas. And in Chile now, based on those policy changes, you can't. So those restrictions, again, the parallel to tobacco is the same, you know. And look, you know, now it's become, everything's driven by social acceptability. In today's world, you're not going to light up a cigarette in a restaurant, whereas a few decades ago, that was common practice. And, you know, again, we look back in the course of our lives, and oh, yeah, you know, like I look back when I was in residency in Detroit, there were still sort of these remnants of these ashtrays in our auditorium when we'd go to grand rounds or lectures every week. Because that was, you know, culture changes over time. And so our culture today is still, you know, bankrupt in certain ways, especially when it comes to food marketing, and more, you know, ethically, morally. So,
right. And the analogy, you know, of food to tobacco, you know, I think has a lot of parallels, as you're describing, in terms of what it's doing to our health. And, you know, and we don't really think about it, because when culture is so prevalent, it becomes the norm, right? So then it's doing what everyone else is doing, which isn't always the right thing, but it's not necessarily an outlier either. And it's a two-part thing, right? Because you can have policy, but if that's what people want, then, you know, there's a kind of push and pull in all this, right? Because a lot of marketing is driven by demand. And there was, you know, and then, of course, it drives demand as well, you know. So the effective point to kind of turn this around and make that culture change is probably on multiple levels, right? You can do some educational work around just, you know, demand, helping people understand what exactly is happening inside their bodies, right? And then there's the policy level where it's kind of being done for you, and it's on a subconscious level driving decision making.
Right. And I think, you know, what I've, as you know, I've become part of you know, startup and trying to sell a product, you realize that is people do make decisions by emotion more than anything. And for those of us coming from especially from the world of academics or in the nonprofit world, you want to believe that education alone is good enough. I mean, I do agree with you. I think it has to be a multi-pronged, sort of intervention overall, because the public policy changes. No one's really fighting for that right now, for, you know, really making huge, the massive shifts in policy for the way food is marketed today. It's going to take time. So we have to come up with other strategies. Education is definitely important. But as I've come to kind of, it's been a little, again, as an educator, you know, my background in education, really, I've been a bit disheartened, I think, sometimes to realize it's not just about telling people,
sure.
You know, because if you have to look at, you know, this becomes a neurochemical thing. You know, our brains are wired in a way, and there's these dopamine responses we get just from, you know, the visual that we know of food. And so we need to look at it like addiction. And I think it's made me reexamine the way, you know, how healthcare works in terms of prevention. And people come and see their doctor once a year, and we, for me, once a year, and it's going to be, you know, well, you know, kind of eat better, and we'll repeat your stuff next year. And as soon as you leave, I remember the last time I left a doctor's office, you know, not only, you know, is there the opportunity potentially for a McDonald's in a lobby, but there's also, you know, we forget, there's like the vending machines. There's the magazines laying out on the coffee table. And, you know, there's cues, there's visual cues and ads that associate happiness to indulgence. And so in the end, it's like, if you're an addict and you're trying to get off of this thing that's, you know, is actually shortening your life, then it's kind of weird when all of a sudden your roommate basically is a dealer. You know, or you're in your car and you walk through, as you're driving down the road and see that $4 deal ad, or walk into the lobby of any place where the vending machines are just like, well, you know, just, they don't have a candy bar if you're a little hungry in between meals.
Yeah.
I drove by Chick-fil-A the other day at 3:30 in the afternoon, and it was kind of, I was frustrated because at first I didn't know what was blocking traffic, and it was 3:30 in the afternoon. I thought it was just Atlanta traffic. No, it was a Chick-fil-A with the cars in the drive-thru spilling out into the street at 3:30 in the afternoon on a weekday. And I was blown away. But this, again, is, you know, this is, there's something.
That's when school gets out. That's the traffic jam.
That's interesting, yeah. You know, I would hope there's something better than just, like, people want a quick fix, you know. But it's, again, it is... I'm not trying to preach, because I struggle with it too. I mean, we go through our lives when we're busy, and we all want to indulge. And I love food, and I like to enjoy food, and so I'm trying to make up a little bit from Thanksgiving and my indulgence. And there's nothing wrong with enjoying and indulging in food. It's just, you know, moderation should be easier in today's world, and it's not. Moderation is hard for the average consumer, and you know that drives everything.
Yeah, the point about the visual cues, I think, is just so important, because I see people struggle. I struggle because, you know, the way we desire food are really driven by largely subconscious choices. Like, it caters to the part of our brain that is triggered by having the environment trigger our desire for food, and that overpowers our metabolic needs of when we're full and when we're hungry. So whether it's stress, whether it's an ad, whether it's just the smell of a chocolate chip cookie, that actually stimulates our bodies to want food even when we're full. So I think there's a lot to be said for structuring our environment where we don't have to fight our own instincts to eat healthy.
Right.
Which I think is a you know, something that we can strive for nationally, because I think it's very difficult for an individual to do that, because you're asking the person in some ways to not be human. I mean, this is how we're wired.
Right. Right. Now I'm craving chocolate chip cookies.
Power of suggestion.
Yeah, it's like, well, yeah, I do like this. I always tell people I have like a master's degree in chocolate chip cookies. I really like chocolate chip cookies.
But let me rephrase that. Then you're walking by smelling the waft of broccoli. See if I can reprogram that.
Broccoli.
So you started this company, Choose. tell me, what is Juice and why did you start this?
So I didn't start it. So my friend started it. My friend Liddell Hill, he's sort of a holistic trainer. He is just this incredible, the best way to describe him, he's like sort of a force of nature. As a youth, he was a gifted athlete. He was raised by a grandfather who was part African American, part Native American, and he really embodied sort of the Native American heritage his grandfather did in terms of natural healing, living off the land, and really about herbs, plants. And so his grandfather raised him from age 5 on a farm in Lebanon, Tennessee, and that's what Liddell grew up with. His grandfather was sort of the local herb guy. You know, when people would go to natural remedies, they go to his grandfather. And Liddell he went through his own sort of evolution of being an athlete for a little bit in college and then going out being a weightlifter on the West Coast. And he admits to trying everything, you know, protein powders and steroids and these things. And he remembers one day he came back. His grandfather was in his 80s, and he came back to visit in Tennessee, and he said his grandfather's handshake, the grip was stronger than his. And, you know, and he just realized, wow, you know, I need to go back to this. And that was, you know, I mean, I think about 20 years ago, he said he eventually moved to Atlanta, and he wanted to always make his grandfather's way of life more portable for himself. And he would walk around with this jug of stuff, and he was training people at this time. But then eventually he kind of got inspired to go back to his grandfather's wisdom, hit the textbooks and understand the science behind it, and realize science validated a lot of his grandfather's wisdom. You know, pull a sweet potato out of the ground for a snack while you're outside working, brush it off, that was his grandfather's snack. So he created, Juice eventually, something for him, a portable kind of optimal fuel, a combination of, more than 35 plants, fruits, vegetables, herbs, nuts, and seeds, in what he thought would be the perfect combination, and made it chewable because rather than just liquid, which juices are, you're missing, the most important part of the plant is in the architecture, in the fiber, and the plants have been around for a billion years longer than we have, and they've survived, they've adapted, to survive. Because of the things intrinsic inside of their structure, so he came made it this chewable, weird looking product, and eventually his clients became interested in it. I was a total skeptic when I first, because I was just training with him. I just turned 40, and I was trying to. I realized I needed to get. I was my health was going a bit wayward, and so I just started really spending a lot of time training with him, and then arguing with him. Because I thought I knew a lot about health. I thought, I am this doctor, and I know what health is. It's 50% about exercise and 50% about eating less. And eventually, I realized
I know who won.
Yeah, I realized that it became an aha moment around that time. It was just noticing sort of these different facts coming up about childhood obesity. And about understanding how pop culture and movements in pop culture can influence behavior patterns so much. And so initially I was a skeptic of what he'd created in Juice, but eventually, as I listened more and realized I was wrong about a lot of these things, I started realizing that what he'd created was totally absent on the market. All these grab and go kind of quote unquote healthy products, and then the juice industry's history and evolution has not necessarily helped, mankind. And it's not, I wouldn't even just put it down to just these companies. In medicine, in our medical research, I think we also kind of maybe were kind of a little bit arrogant with the idea, this belief we found out cholesterol 30, 40 years ago. Like, this is the problem. We found the marker. Now it's done, and the food world changed because of, this saying, but it's so much more than just cholesterol, right? But we kind of, I think there was a degree of arrogance there, and look at where we are now. So, I saw this as an opportunity to be behind something that could actually, if it were adopted into mainstream culture, could actually help people live healthier, and because people want convenience. They want something that's tasty, that's convenient, and So that, you know, kind of launched that, where I started getting involved as putting together a small investor group to kind of come in and say, let's support this. Let's see. Let's try and let's get it to market. Doing some research behind it was important to me as well, because I really felt like more, not necessarily to market it, because I think this is, I've learned in all of this, I'd rather the brand be something we can under-promise and over-deliver on, rather than trying. I think there's been enough snake oils around for a long time. People want a magic pill that doesn't exist. And why not get behind something the right way, that just to, yeah, under-promise and over-deliver? So that's kind of led to a couple of research projects we've done with it.
And just to kind of look at what chooses and what's out there. So, you know, I know myself and a lot of my patients, you know, everyone wants to get more fruits and vegetables in. It's kind of hard to get the recommended amount. And then there's all the chopping and prepping. So putting something in a blender and grabbing it to go has a lot of appeal. And when you look at kind of the landscape, so there's juicing, which is just extracting the juice, which leaves behind the fiber, right? Then there's smoothies, which are very popular. And then there's juice.
Yeah.
And just for our listeners, if you could maybe talk a little bit about the pros and cons of each, right? Because this fiber component,
yeah,
and then, yeah, how you pulverize and how the body processes it is very different in these three scenarios, even though they all start off with fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Let's say juices, especially pressed juices, let's call it, that these premium juices, I'd say the pro is that it's helped introduce more Americans to the idea of the benefits of plant-based foods, or just plants, you know, and mostly in phytochemicals. So like nutrients from food are either going to be micronutrients or macronutrients. Micronutrients are vitamins and minerals. So we just need those things in small, you know, quantities to help kind of our cells function a little bit better. And then there's the macronutrients, which are, you know, your fat, you know, carbohydrates and protein. These are what we get calories from. We need in larger quantities. But fiber is also kind of a subcategory of carbohydrates, a non-digestible carbohydrate. And, you know, this, we don't digest fiber, but our, you know, microbiome bacteria do. Juices have all these phytochemicals, micronutrients, vitamins and minerals. When they press, you know, the fruits and vegetables, they get all the liquid out. But they leave all the architecture behind, so there's the fiber you're missing. So, and you are getting carbohydrates, depending on what you're pressing or juicing. You know, you can get some, you know, some fats and proteins as well, but you're leaving behind the most important thing that's missing in the American diet today, which is fiber. And so, you know, that's where juices are. So they're refreshing. You know, it's in terms as refreshments. Even how they, you know, we see this extension into pressed juices. It's a great extension for what the beverage industry is trying to latch onto. Grab and go, it's convenient. But it is not a food replacement, and it does not address what the average American really is devoid of. So that's juices. You know, with smoothies, which are popular, which, you know, it's better. Like when people are doing the Vitamix, they are keeping the whole plant intact. And they're not. It's not just juicing. What we found with smoothies, which you know can be great, especially when people are making them at home and really balancing the macro and micronutrients they're getting, and especially keeping fiber. And what we've seen, you know, for the most part, the general smoothie, because you're adding a lot of other liquids and stuff with calories, I think the calorie to fiber ratio can get high. You know, so as, you know, it's like in our product, it's 150 calories, 6 grams of fiber. With a lot of smoothies, you can see, you know, 300 to 500 calories for about 5 to 6 grams of fiber. Sometimes it can be higher. That's great. But that's where it should be optimized, is really getting, in looking at nutrient density, with fiber being, you know, really one of the most important things, getting fiber, you know, calorie to fiber ratio in that range where for every 100 calories, you're getting at least 3 grams of fiber. And so, you know, that's sort of where the difference for juice. We do 2/3 of our ingredients are chopped or blended. there is some juice in there, but it's been, you know, kind of minimized so that the, a lot of the crucial things that leafy greens, a lot of our, all our nuts and seeds, obviously, we have, even kiwi. Kiwi is something we wash. We don't peel it. We chop it, and it's old. The skin and the fruit are both in there because some of the most potent nutrients are in the skin of the kiwi, not in the fruit. So our product actually has, you're having kiwi skin, that's actually in there, but we made it into a product that is incredibly delicious and filling. So, that's where, it's totally, it's 35 different fruits, vegetables, herbs, nuts, and seeds. So it's kind of, it's different, and it's awkward, we'll call it, it's awkwardly delicious.
That's a great term, awkwardly delicious. I just tried juice, and it's definitely different from anything I've tried, and I loved it. And just to recap, so the juice, pressed juice or juicing, you get the juice extracted, which is mostly carbs, but fiber stays behind, right? Mm-hmm. So you throw out the, parts, for example, of the orange that are not juiceable. And when you kind of take out the fiber, so a lot of the nutrients, the, all the minerals and vitamins are attached to the fiber. So you actually lose a little bit of the nutritional value in addition to the fiber by extracting the fiber. And of course, you don't get the benefit for the gut bacteria. The smoothies, you get the fiber because you're putting in the fruit. But then, of course, you're processing it to the point where it's more of a liquid texture, which takes away some of the work of digestion and affects the kind of how our body absorbs the carbs when it is kind of broken down to a liquid. And then there's juice. So for our listeners who have never heard of juice before, it's this really delicious chunky vegetable juice. That's probably how I would describe it, with fruits and vegetables. And it has like a, it's like drinking a healthy soup of sorts. Like it has that chunky texture. And having that fiber intact before it's broken down to this liquid form has a very unique benefit, which is really why it stands out from these other two. And that really speaks to what you just mentioned, which is the role of how the fiber interacts with our gut bacteria. And why is it so important that we have these fibers? Like, what is it doing inside of our bodies?
Yeah, this is... This is exciting because, and we do, by the way, our, product, I describe it as like nowadays we're really, it's a juicy super salad. It's like how we've kind of come to really helping people understand. This is like, so imagine if, you get some juice, but you get a lot of super salad. You put, juices are portable. Salads, and especially really, really, densely nutritious salads are not so portable. We figured out a way to kind of just do that. It's not, rocket science. We just kind of put them in a bottle, made it easier for people. But this is the ingredients anyone can get at home. Yeah. Just people want it easier. So
that's the beauty of it. It is home ingredients.
Yeah, this is where, this is where I just kind of blown away with what my friend Liddell created in that way. With the fiber, this science is just now advancing on this in terms of everyone knew fiber was, good for you. Oh, it was help, so you don't get constipated, et cetera. It turns out, it is, there's this new window that's opened into the world of, immunology and in understanding, the relationship between these microorganisms that live within us, the probiotic bacteria, as people know, probiotics. In an average adult, this is a few pounds. If you put all these trillions of cells together of these good parasites that live within us and coexist with us and, for generations as well, they have their own genealogy of coexisting along with us. It turns out that with these, all these different strains and colonies of good bacteria, they are nourished by prebiotic fiber. So we don't digest fiber, but they do. And what we now know and what the science has been advancing more recently is showing is that relationship is based on a lot of different things. But getting nourished with prebiotic fiber, one of the things it helps do is helps develop a healthy mucus layer between the bacteria and your intestinal wall. So the inner lining of your intestine, the epithelium, the smooth layer inside of your intestine, the inner, pink-looking wall. You want your bacteria to live close to it, but they're separated by a mucus layer. And if that mucus layer is thick and healthy, you keep a safe distance between the bacteria, the carpet of bacteria, and your intestinal wall. And having that distance is really crucial, because the closer, if you have a thinner, unhealthy mucus layer, those bacteria get closer to your intestinal lining, and it provokes inflammatory responses. Keeps its distance. Digesting prebiotic fiber, especially, is partly how it does creates a good, healthy mucus layer. It also helps to produce systemic anti-inflammatory molecules, these short-chain fatty acid molecules that go around your body and act as anti-inflammatory agents to help you work better. So this is science in the last few years that has really opened up a sort of a new window into how we understand how we coexist with these microorganisms within us, and that we have all these colonies. With the beauty of, like, I feel like the science has caught up with CHOOSE now, which is great, because it turns out it's not just I can just take a prebiotic fiber supplement. Now, it turns out these organisms like different types. They all have different strains. They all are different colonies. We have different strains, you know, is when we go measure them nowadays, as people sometimes do. With all these strains, they all prefer different plant fibers. And so they like them as natural as possible. And so with all of this advancing science, we get to come to understand that grandma was right. Eat more fruits and vegetables. Eat more whole fruits and vegetables. And eat a diverse array of them, not just, you know, I think in the past we'd say eat the rainbow. And I think a lot of it was based on micronutrients, you know, like, you know, oh, you get a vast array of vitamins and minerals if you really eat different color, like more than 5 to 7 different colors of fruits and vegetables each day. But it's not just the micronutrients. Now the science is really showing us the diverse array of prebiotic fiber from a diverse array of plants helps all of these colonies work better. And this one article that came out last month showed that immigrants coming to this country come in with this diversity in their microbiome, so microbial diversity. So all these colonies are flourishing and helping coexist. And what the study showed was that over time, as the immigrants are in America, they adopt American lifestyle, American way of eating, they lose the microbial diversity. And so, you know, if all of us could find a way to make it easy to eat tons of plants every day, that'd be great. And, you know, this is what I'm hoping now, that this science has caught up with what CHOOSE is. I think that, you know, this is where, you know, some of their research collaboration is going as well, is to really see how we can help become a product that can help people reset their microbiome by actually, you know, nourishing those strains of bacteria that really can work, help us work better.
Right. And you know, I think, you know, the terms always use good bacteria, bad bacteria for the gut. And, you know, intuitively, most people know they want to have a good gut bacterial balance of good to bad. And what I don't think is emphasized enough is what you just mentioned, which is the importance of diversity of the gut bacteria for a healthy gut bacterial mix. And 70% of our immune system, of course, is in the gut. So that spills over into our general health, since a lot is driven by inflammation. In that, not all fibers are created equal, right? So different strains feed off of different types of fiber. There isn't just one type of fiber. And getting the abundance, like the 35 fruits or vegetables that you can get in one product, stimulates so many different types of good bacteria, which is different than, say, these fiber supplements that you put, you know, a capful with water and drink it down. That's just one type of fiber. So it's very different. The term prebiotic, you know, this will be my last question to you. You know, people know of probiotics, but I know from my experience, I lose people when I use the term prebiotic. Can you maybe talk through why you can't get the same benefit taking probiotics or foods that are marketed with probiotics versus prebiotics like in CHOOSE?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yes, probiotics are popular, and what we currently have commercially in products that say they have probiotics in them, yes, there could be benefit if the colony count is high enough, right? And you are deficient, but you know it is you have to nourish it. So let's say you recruit different battalions of an army that are inside of you and say, I'm going to, you know, probiotic is like, I'm going to have, it's like Army, Navy, you know, Air Force. And this is like, I'm the different battalions inside of me, but they all have completely different preferences for what, how they have to eat. Let's say they all had different diets. And the probiotic tier is like having, okay, yeah, I'm going to have these. But then if you aren't nourishing them with what they actually need to survive, and your diet is devoid of things that they, that makes them happy and thrives, then you're not really doing them a service in the end. You know, yes, after someone's had some kind of illness and getting, replacing with real, you know, probiotic, you know, in a, you know, something that is medical grade that is actually has a high enough colony count, they could, you could definitely repopulate, have some benefit. And if this person also has a lifestyle where they are consuming a lot of whole plants and, you know, the whole, you know, plant-based whole food, that's no problem. But the problem is the average consumer, and only 5% of Americans get the recommended daily minimum amount of fiber. And the Institute of Medicine has declared this, you know, this is a public health concern, and it's been going on for a long time. But again, we've known about it, and we try to educate, but it can't hit onto pop culture. It's very hard. As much as I would love to believe that we as doctors can just tell people this is how you have to live, but that's just, it's been a paradigm shift in the last 3 decades with the digital reality we live in and social media. It is the influence and how we drive decision making is so much more complicated. It's difficult.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's so helpful. And you know, to your point, there, we all look for fast and convenient, and which is why I love having a product that has all these healthy things. But there's also at the same time no quick fix. You can't take a supplement of one strain of a probiotic and get the same diversity of gut bacteria proliferating as you do with these prebiotics that our own bodies kind of utilize and feed our good bacteria. So I love kind of the good old fashioned going back to the farm type advice, and thank you for all the work you're doing. I think this is such a creative and needed super salad, as mm-hmm. you said, mm-hmm. In such a wonderful way to put a product on the market that makes it fast and easy and convenient. And it's the true thing. It's not just marketing. So thank you for doing
thank
that.
Thank you. And you can get it at chuice.com, chuice.com. We used to be in Whole Foods, but in Atlanta, but now we only ship online. So people can buy 12 bottles and get shipped to them. And yeah, we make it simple.
And you order, each one is 8 ounces. So they're in little bottles, convenient to go, and they arrive
cold. Yep. It's perishable. It's real food, so it can go bad. So they come in insulated packaging. It's all biodegradable and recyclable, and we are still evolving it. We want to make it better and better as we go.
That's great. And from the time people receive it, it lasts for how many?
At least, you know, usually it's going to be at least 2 to 3 weeks that you have to consume it.
2 to 3. Oh, that's actually really good. So you can keep your batch in the fridge and just grab it on the way out the door.
And freeze it and, you know, buy as much as you want. Freeze it and then, you know, save it for later. It freezes great.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been just a wonderful opportunity to talk.
Thank you as well. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.